can go from laptop to the speakers. But that doesn't include.
Okay, so is it easy to switch so that when you want to generate the sounds to feed that, you can just do the switch then?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess.
It may mean you don't have my resonant voice now and then, but that's okay. I don't mind that. I don't mind that.
You'll just have to give them a heads up and then do the switch.
Are you okay with that? Okay.
I'm going to sit here and watch the feedback.
We have lots of manual labor tonight. All right. My name's Mike O'Bannon. I am a psychologist. I tell you that because it will explain some of the biases you might hear in my talk. And I'm hearing a fair amount of feedback. Is that a problem for you? No. Okay. and now I'm not hearing myself at all.
Okay, actually it's good for the stream, so.
Okay. Can everyone hear me if I try to talk, speak up? Okay. I know the room's a little dark, but let me ask a couple of quick questions to help with this talk. This talk is going to be brief, but I'd like it to be useful for you, or at least interesting, or at least keep you in the room. How many of you would consider yourselves more artists than technical folks? Would you raise your hand? Okay, I'm counting maybe five or six hands. How many of you are more programmers, techies than artists? All righty. You don't get a chance to be both in this question. You know, it's either or. How many of you just ended up in the room and you're wondering how to get out of it? Okay, a couple, and you're welcome to stay. We're happy to have you or go. So I'm going to talk tonight about a sort of a sideline of mine. I'm a psychologist, but I generally work with business and industry for my day job. However, I was trained as a physiological psychologist, a laboratory researcher, originally way back in the dark ages. And these were dark ages when there were vacuum tubes rather than transistors. In most of our equipment, and my work in those days and as a basement hobby and tinkerer over the last, I'll allow you to guess how many years, has been in working with biosignals, the signals that our bodies generate, and trying to get some sense of how they might be useful and what we might do with them. Tonight I'm going to talk about how we might generate sound and music from those signals. I do other things with them that are therapeutic, that have to do with meditation, that have to do with peak performance and human potential development, and I will not talk about those today. But they border. There is an overlap with what I'm talking about tonight and those kind of applications. So let's talk a little bit about music and brainwaves. We're going to, because a lot of you are techies, and Dale asked me to. I'm going to talk a little bit about the workflow that I use in processing the EEG. So we will talk about the programming side a little bit, but I will also play some music for you. And I will also play some other pieces, and you'll have to decide whether they're music or not. And we will actually process live brainwaves from someone you know and love who's in the room. Generating music from the EEG is not a new thing. These are pictures taken in the mid-60s, and I'm sure you know the fellow on the left-hand side who has a kind of iconic profile. Do you know the fellow on the right-hand side? Anybody who hasn't seen these, my talk before? Any guesses? No, it is not Jesus. Although there is a strong resemblance. This is John Cage. In case any of you recognize the name, John Cage was a tremendous innovator between, I guess, the late 40s and well into the 70s or early 80s in music, both electronic music and other types of highly experimental music. John Cage did not make his living as a musician, and some of you, if you heard his pieces, would probably agree that that's appropriate. His pieces, in many cases, arose from randomness, from technological processes out in the world. But in this case, his brainwaves are actually being used to generate music. Both of these fellows worked with a person who's still working today, David Rosenboom, who's on the West Coast in a university music school, with a hardware system that processed brainwaves and translated them into a kind of music. And what I'd like to do is play you just a little segment of David Rosenboom's pieces. These are not the brainwaves of John Lennon or John Cage, but they are processed with the same algorithm and hardware, and there would be very similar types of sound if we were listening to their brainwaves. And what I'd like to do now is switch, as you can see. I'm not a Mac person. I'd like to switch over and play the sound channel for just a second. Okay. That's David Rosenboom's system. This was a recording done in 1972. However, it was first seen publicly on the Mike Douglas Show a little bit earlier in around 1968, if I remember correctly. And you'll notice that once exposed to these sounds, strange things happen to your eyes. Actually, Mike Douglas was very taken with it. If we had more time, I would play you a segment of this show, which has John and Yoko and David and Mike all hooked up to an early electronic music synthesizer generating those kinds of sounds. Very interesting kind of historical piece, I guess. If we think about the brain and musical performance and actually listening to music, there's a couple of things to keep in mind. This is a very simple model that I work with. We pick up a signal from the brain that we call the electroencephalogram. It is a very tiny signal. We are measuring in the range of about 5 to 20 microvolts, millionths of a volt, from the surface of the head. And we're picking up activity of brain structures, which we then process with some sort of algorithm, and feed back to the person who is providing those brain waves. And it has two types of effect on listeners. First of all, it has an information value. It tells the person a little bit about what that area of the brain, of their own brain, is actually doing. So we can use that information for the person to then learn better control of their own brain, and as a result, better control of their own consciousness, and sometimes symptoms as well. There's also an evocative piece, that is, the musical signal that we feed back evokes emotions and evokes the kinds of responses that we all have when we listen to certain musical pieces. So there are two flows of feedback to the listener that have to be taken into account. Generally, what goes on in the world is that only one or the other is taken into account. For instance, in conventional performance, we have no brainwave at all. We only have an evocative signal, which is generated by a composer who expects a certain type of response, usually in the listener, if it's not one of those composers who really doesn't care how the listener responds. And no matter how often they say that, I think they probably do. Then we have music therapy, where music is chosen to have a particular beneficial effect for the listener, still evocation. And what we're talking about tonight, and what you've heard from David Rosenboom's piece, is something we call sonification. That is a kind of ignoring of the feedback qualities of music that we generate and simply translating the EEG into some sort of sound, perhaps noise, perhaps music. Sonification has been done in many ways over the years, and what I'm going to show you tonight is basically sonification, because we don't really have time to work with the evocative or the information value of the process. However, it's important to remember that both of those processes are present. And a lot of my own work has to do with how one can embed in a software system a little bit of intelligence, sometimes a fair amount of intelligence, so that the system chooses evocative stimuli or evocative qualities of the music in order to enhance a particular brain rhythm or a particular brain state. When we combine the evocative possibilities of music with the informational possibilities of feeding back sound to a person, we can create some really powerful types of experiences for people that not only allow them to go away saying, wow, but also allow them to grow and develop certain capacities that they may not have had with the same strength and ability before they were exposed to the system. So my eventual aim here is something that I'm not really talking about therapy, although it sounds like therapy. I'm more interested in what well-functioning people can do in order to continue to improve their capacities beyond their current level of functioning. And I believe that EEG feedback technologies have a capability for doing that if they're designed in a proper way to use both evocation and information feedback. Tonight we're going to do sonification, which is the first step, translating the signal from the brain into sound or music. More recently, there have been a number of attempts, and I thought I would allow you to hear some of these that have been done by other folks. There was a very interesting symposium in Sydney, Australia, done in 2004 by some folks who actually have been colleagues of mine at one point or another in training and research in the area of EEG. It was an invitational symposium where a number of musicians who were also technicians were provided with one person's electroencephalogram, that is a recording of brain waves from a person, lasted about 3 minutes. There were 24 channels of data and approximately 800 megabytes of data from the brain, which is not a great deal in terms of today's technology. Each of these musician technologists then translated that particular set of brainwave recordings into a piece of music. And we'll not listen to the entirety of any of these, but there is a kind of message I'd like you to gain from hearing a sample of a few of these. Let's listen to the first one. This is a piece called, pardon me, I'm looking for my cursor, called Mind Your Body by Roger Dean and Associates. All right. The second piece, and I'd like you to compare the two pieces in your own head for a second, is a piece called Listen. It's actually a part of a larger piece called Awakening by David Palin. And let's take a listen to what that particular one sounds like, if I can get the cursor there. Okay, And then let's listen to a third piece, and I'd like you to compare it to the other two that you've heard, called Perceptions in C by John Sanderson. And then finally, just a quick clip from a piece called Neural Dialogues by Pittard and Scheimer. Whoops. Pardon me. Working with the EEG does not guarantee psychomotor skills. I'm sorry, I'm having a lot of trouble finding my cursor. Any thoughts about those four pieces? Remember, they all came from the same person's brainwave record, the same 3-minute record. In fact, most of them came from the beginning of that 3-minute record, to give you a hint about the answer I'd like to hear. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? They're real different, aren't they? Same brainwaves, real, real different. And the point I'm making here is that when we do sonification of the EEG, we have two actors or agents participating. We have an algorithm which is generating the actual music and maybe composing it to some extent, meaning choosing notes, durations, rhythms, timbres. So we have an algorithm, and then we have a modulation of the algorithm by the brainwaves, by the person's actual biological signal. The final output is a participation of those two processes, and in fact, by altering your algorithm, you can substantially alter what the brain sounds like. And the point here is that the brain doesn't really sound like anything in particular. In fact, let's talk a little bit about what the brain does sound like, so to speak. The signal that we're working with from the brain, again, someplace between usually 5 and 20 microvolts, extremely small, much smaller than the signal that's actually transmitted through the air by 60-cycle AC. In this room, the signals that we'll be working with the EEG in a few minutes, with this headset, are probably 100 to 1,000 times smaller than just the ambient electrical noise in the room. And this is a problem, but one that our electronics, fortunately, can take care of usually. The signal we're looking at generally resides below 60 cycles, usually in the range of about 1 hertz to 32 hertz in terms of frequency. And I'm sure as most of you, or perhaps all of you know, you can't really hear 32 hertz. You can feel it, but you can't hear it. So we're working with a signal that is much smaller or a much lower frequency than what we normally hear and think of as music. And we're translating it into music. You've probably all seen these standard EEG frequency bands. The EEG begins at a very low frequency with slow waveforms that are usually associated with sleep and low levels of mental activity, and rises into the range of 16 to 32 hertz, which generally represents wakefulness and relatively high brain metabolism. You can actually think of this as kind of a range of the degree of metabolism that is going on in the area of the brain that you are measuring. The higher frequency you measure, generally the more activated that particular brain structure is, and usually the more activated the person whose EEG you're measuring is at the time. These signals come from neurons. Someplace in all of our science classes, we've been exposed to the fact that neural spikes travel down axons, impinge upon dendrites of other neurons, and this is the way the brain works. This is not where the EEG comes from. The EEG comes from a kind of generalized depolarization of the cell membrane of neurons, and those add up because when we put an electrode on someone's head to measure the signal, we generally measure a signal from about 50,000 neurons at one time. And as their membranes fluctuate in terms of the positive and negative charge, they generate these frequencies between 1 and 32 hertz that we work with then to translate into sound and music. It's important to remember that one doesn't just get a brainwave signal, a brainwave signal that where one measures on the head really determines the type of signal that one is going to be working with. For instance, if I put an electrode on the back of your head, this is a brain where the eyes are pointing to the left and the back of the head is to the right. So if I put electrodes over the occipital lobe, I will generally detect activity that has to do with perception and sensation. If I put electrodes more toward the front of the brain, on the frontal, or what's called the prefrontal, which is the very forwardmost part of the brain, then I will get what are called executive signals reflecting executive activity. These are decisions you're making about what to do next, planning, anticipating, and to some extent high-level analyzing of the world. So we can select where we put our electrodes and where we get our signals. Tonight we're going to be getting a signal from the executive functions, from the frontal lobes. Dale asked me to talk a little bit about workflow, and I'll do this, and then I will actually show you some computer programming that is actually driving music generation from brainwaves. When I'm in the home laboratory, which means I'm sequestered in the corner of my living room, or sometimes in the basement, I'm using clinical EEG equipment. I am trained as a neuropsychologist, and so most of my work is done with clinically certified equipment. There's a reason we're going to be using equipment that is not falling into that category tonight that I'll talk about in a moment. I generally use a piece of software to process that signal that is basically a set of filters, just like the filters you use in electronic music, except they operate on a little bit lower frequency within the 1 to 32 hertz range, and they tend to be a little narrower in terms of smaller frequency range than filters for music processing. That software generates a MIDI signal. I route that MIDI signal into a processing language that will allow me to write composition algorithms. The one I use mostly is Max 5.1. Some of you may recognize this as a DSP, sound and music control and multimedia language. It's the commercial predecessor of Pure Data, and it's a relatively sophisticated platform for controlling both sound and video, used today by a lot of our more innovative artists, and also used by Cirque du Soleil to generate some of their effects. And then usually I use a sound generator, a hardware sound generator, a processor. I like the Nord G2 and the Evolver. These are synthesizer, rack synthesizer modules. Sometimes I will work inside of Max with an embedded VST, which is another type of sound generator, or it's actually a software synthesizer. I like Massive and so do a lot of people doing dubstep these days. I occasionally will drive drum machines, and I like to layer on reverb, so I use the Eventide Eclipse a lot. This is basically my workflow at home. The workflow we're going to be looking at tonight is a little simpler because I can travel a little lighter. We're going to be using, and I've been experimenting most recently with devices that are, first of all, inexpensive. The clinical equipment ranges from a few thousand to many thousand dollars per box. The device we're going to be using tonight is on the order of about $150, and it's a new headset that's being put out by a company related to computer gaming that does a pretty credible job of detecting brainwaves. It has a Bluetooth connection into the Mac that I'll be using, and it actually, in the headset itself, there is a microprocessor that breaks down the EEG into frequency bands so that what we receive on the other end of the Bluetooth connection is data, basically, already processed EEG. We'll be running it into Max 5.1. Max allows me to embed a number of programming languages inside of the Max environment. You can work with JavaScript, Java, Python. God forbid you can work with Lisp. And I worked with all of those tonight. Most of the programming will be in JavaScript. And I'll be using Max as the actual sound generator, so it's going to be a little dry. We don't have my reverb to liven it up a little bit. Probably a little bit less complex than what we might normally expect from a hardware rack synthesizer. Let me just cover some quick misconceptions about EEG before we generate a little bit of sound and music. Here are the things you need to know about what EEG control music, or what EEG cannot do today. Most people think that when I originally say I work with brainwave control of music, they generally think that I am able to hook someone up to my equipment. They think about a tune, and lo and behold, it comes out the speaker. This is not the way this kind of technology works. We are not yet to the point where you can intend a particular melody or a particular musical effect and have it immediately occur. What we're actually doing is we are measuring the activation and deactivation of brain structures. And we usually know what those brain structures are doing to some extent, and we're mapping them on to a music generation algorithm. So the specificity of response selection is not there yet. I do believe that within probably a matter of 7 to 10 years, we're going to be able to control music generators in a much more fine-grained fashion, but we can't do it yet. And particularly, we can't get the temporal granularity. When you pick a banjo or play a keyboard, you actually control the onset of notes on the range of 5 to 10 milliseconds. These brainwave activities, until one becomes good at controlling a particular signal, can sometimes take a matter of seconds, minutes, or may take several sessions, meaning several hours, to learn to control, and then you don't control them on a millisecond basis. There is contamination by external noise with this technology. We constantly deal with noisy electrical environments, and I'm not sure what will happen tonight. It'll be interesting to see. We've got a lot of equipment around, but I think we'll be able to deal with it. The EEG technology itself is formulated or is designed basically to suppress this noise, but sometimes it gets through. And finally, there's high sensitivity to artifact. What most people who get into doing this type of work don't realize is that movement, bodily movement, jaw clenching, deep breathing, raising your eyebrows, muscle impulses, can interfere with this process substantially. So we have to have a very quiet and cooperative helper. And I understand that you are a very quiet and cooperative helper. Is that correct? We've subjugated a person from your community here and and ask him to be our subject. So what I'm going to do is very quickly put on an EEG headset and see what kind of sound we can get from his brain. Is that okay? All right. Why don't we put you...
It's Carlos.
Why don't we put you here so folks can see what I'm doing? I know it's dark.
Yes, absolutely. Which channel are we looking to use?
We're going to be coming off
computer?
The laptop.
Okay.
Yeah. And what I'm going to do is use the Mindset headset. Most people who have had this headset on them come away relatively unscarred. Sometimes, and we can usually rehabilitate any sort of neurological damage that might occur.
We want to do this again. We know what
you're okay.
Oh yeah.
What I'm doing is I'm using a little alcohol to take off kind of skin oils so that we can get a good connection. I'm putting the headset on so that experimenters don't always come away wrong, not brain damaged. I'm putting the headset on so that we basically detect a signal from the frontal lobes. That's what this arm does. There's an electrical connection here, and there's an electrical connection over here by the ear. And then I've got a Bluetooth signal coming to the laptop. And if you'll give me just a moment, I'm going to open up a Bluetooth connection. What I have here now, What I have here now is a Bluetooth connection to Carlos's prefrontal lobe, actually. It's his left prefrontal lobe. And if you look at the box down in the lower left-hand corner, you're seeing four EEG channels that are being processed about once every roughly 1,000 milliseconds. They run from 4 hertz to a top end of 16 hertz, roughly in equal frequency bands. And I'm going to use that signal to drive a couple of musical algorithms. Let's see what we get here. I'm assigning the bottom channel to one channel of a polyrhythm generator, the frequency of the actual beeps that you hear represent the amplitude of the bottom or the lowest EEG channel, 4 to 8 hertz. Let's add a little bit and see if we can make it a little bit more musical. Okay, that's just the second channel. If we add in the top two channels, maybe we can get a little more variety. For the geeks in the room, here's the actual Max programming patch. Max is a visual programming language, and embedded in most of these boxes are small software routines that are actually engaged in the process of generating the sounds, feeding them into the Mac audio system, providing the timing and rhythm, and also making sure the signal is palatable to a listener. We could probably change this into something even more interesting, but let's take a look at something a little different. Remember what I said about sonification. The same brain waves can sound very, very different. And what I'd like to do is show you a very, very different way to process these same brain waves in real time. How many of you know about Mozart's musical dice game? Does that ring a bell with anybody? His musical dice game. Okay. While Mozart was still alive, one of the common practices... I'm sorry? Oh, the microphone is not on? Could we check for the mic? Okay, during Mozart's lifetime, Mozart was a rock star, as most of you probably know. He was both a composer and a performer. Music was real different in those days, though, because people didn't go to concerts nearly as often. They tended to play music in their parlors. And so Mozart produced a way that anyone could actually compose their own music. What he did was generate a number of musical measures that could be strung together, and he placed them into a matrix so that if you selected a measure from each column in the matrix, one after another, created then a musical piece from these measures, you would always get something that sounded reasonably good. And the way to select the measures was to simply roll dice. So this matrix consists of 16 bars of music. Each bar could be any one of 12 different measures. And when you put them together, you get a minuet. What I'm going to do with Carlos's brainwaves tonight is we're going to compose a minuet. But rather than rolling dice, the measures have now been processed to produce an index of musical complexity. So when Carlos's brain waves are showing a very high level of activation, what you'll hear is a measure of music that's relatively complex, written by Mozart. When his brainwaves are relatively relaxed, you'll hear a measure that is less complex, less musically complex. And let's just see what kind of minuet Carlos produces. So here we have combination of brainwaves, Max, Carlos.
Sorry.
Mozart would have really been very disappointed. Let's try one more. All right, let's try one last experiment, last minute, I promise. For those of you who are a little bit disappointed about the music that's come out of Carlos's head so far, let's see if we can do something a little more contemporary. Hang on just a second. And enough. Okay. Frankly, I think it's a little more representative of what most of our brains do these days than the first two. All right. I'd like to thank you for listening. I'd just like to say that I think there's a great deal of potential beyond what I've shown you tonight. This kind of connection between our individual brains and musical output can be used both to help us learn better control of ourselves. It can be used to actually generate musical compositions that are extremely carefully tailored to particular listeners and that can actually produce with relatively high certainty certain types of moods and states of consciousness. For musicians, I talk to them about this technology because I think it's just fun to think about your physiology as kind of another player in the musical group. You can actually play a duet with your own biorhythms with this type of technology. And I guess finally, it's just a great deal of fun. So thanks very much for your time tonight. And Carlos, let's give Carlos a big hand for his brainwaves.